Hello, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
Hello, Julie.
Hello.
How are you over the last 2 weeks?
I'm fine. I'm freezing in Dallas. It's
freezing in Dallas.
For the Super Bowl.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Yes. Have it here again.
Is it going crazy down there?
Yes. The media has been talking about it solid for 3 weeks. They're so excited. We're sick of it.
You know, it's wild to have the Cowboys, probably their two fiercest rivals over the last, I don't know. Well, the Steelers since the 70s, I guess, but you know, those are fierce rivals dueling it out at Cowboys Stadium.
And the town's full of all those rivals, fans, and everybody's going around saying, who do you want to have win? And what I hear the most is, well, anybody but the Packers. which you don't want to say you want the Steelers to win, but you don't want the Packers to win, I guess. So there you go.
I see. That's a tough situation.
I know. Well, that's kind of how I feel about it. Wow. So, but that's because I know enough Packers fans to see that the Cowboys are not the only ones who have fans that might not be the most popular people. I understand why people don't like the Cowboys. I didn't used to, but you know, Packers fans are not doing them so proud.
Gotcha. Well, hopefully they won't trash the place.
Yeah,
well, being all sparkly and new.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Anyway, and how about you?
Oh, doing just fine, doing just fine. It's cold up here, too. Way, way chilly, actually. It's below zero today. Yeah, so, but I've enjoyed reading this book. Get to go to the bayou for a while.
Yes, help keep me warm.
Yep, yep.
Here at A Good Story is Hard to Find. I think we forgot to say that.
Oh, yeah, that's what this is. We're two Catholics talking about books and movies.
Yeah. Yep. That's it. And popular books and movies and the threads we find underneath of the one reality that Catholics should be most interested in.
Right. And this is episode number 3.
Ooh,
and
yes.
And we're going to talk about Black Cherry Blues by James Lee Burke.
Mm-hmm.
So, first let's talk about some feedback we got from the last one.
Yeah. Will Duquette from The View from the Foothills actually listened to an episode, and he never listens to podcasts.
Did he listen to the entire episode? Somebody did?
He did.
Oh,
he
my goodness.
He listened to the one, I think he might have listened to both.
Wow.
Because he actually went out and bought The Reapers or the Angels.
Oh, my goodness.
So he could listen to the first episode. I was so honored.
That's terrific. That is terrific. So how did he feel about the zombie novel?
I think he liked it a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm waiting for him to write a review. Hint, hint. and Joseph from Zombie Parent, who does some things for my other podcast, he went out and got it also, and he's going to write a review, and he liked it very much.
Now, did you say of Zombie Parent?
Yes. He's the parent of some small children, and he says that leaves he and his wife feeling like zombies.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
Isn't that good?
That is good.
And so his posts are usually written from that point of view of the zombie parent or the zombie children, and they're really clever. He's good.
That's great.
So I feel super influential. We got two people to buy a book.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I know.
Fantastic. And does our power have any limit?
Maybe we can get somebody to buy Black Cherry Blues and read it. Then we'll know because we'll be switching genres.
That's right. We are.
But Will had some feedback about our comments about Serenity, so he listened to that one, too.
That's right. That's right. Yep.
And,
he had some very good comments about Serenity.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about those?
Yeah, and one of the things that he said that made me think was, you know, that we didn't discuss any of the negative aspects of that movie. And I can't say I disagree with him because, yeah, I mean, we did say, you know, Joss Whedon is not a Catholic person. He wasn't making a Catholic movie. And I think we were clear on that. But there were some aspects to the movie that we probably could have discussed that would have been interesting to talk about because we did mention that Joss Whedon is a humanist. And there were some humanist things that we probably could have talked about that don't really fit the Catholic viewpoint. I don't think that we were trying to say that this is a Catholic. I think we were pretty clear. This isn't a Catholic movie. it wasn't 100% stuff that would please us in a Catholic way, if I could say it that way. So
yeah, well, and I think almost anything we talk about here is going to be that way, because you expect stuff to be right in, if it's, say, a Catholic book or a Catholic movie. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times what I personally find is that it's not the best writing or art if it's done to be a Catholic book or movie. Mm-hmm. That's not always the case, but I'm just saying a lot of times you hear, you know, oh, it's a Christian movie, and you kind of go, oh, and your expectations get ratcheted down.
Yeah, they go down, right.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of like Scott Nearing from Good News Film Review says, is what we don't need are more Christian movies or books. What we need are Christian artists making good work, because then their worldview is underneath it.
Yeah, yeah, and I agree with that. And we're not out here trying to select, you know, expressly Catholic things. We're mm-hmm. finding Catholic things in, you know, in everything, really.
Which is what we're excited about.
Exactly, exactly. And that's kind of the vision we had. You know, today's book, you know, James Lee Burke happens to be Catholic, but you know, we're not out selecting Catholic authors on purpose. You know, yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I guess the opposite of that is to say, if this author is not Catholic, I don't want to read that. You know, that's not what we're doing here.
No, what we're doing is saying, if you keep your eyes open, a lot of times you're surprised at where you will find things that are illuminating. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's more illuminating, I think, from the fact that it's presented by somebody who's not Catholic, like some of the stuff in Serenity or, you know, The Reapers or The Angels.
Right.
Because it's a truth that's so universal that it's there. They just may not see it the way we do from the same focus.
Right, right.
Does that make sense?
It sure does, yeah. And still, I do agree with Will. I do agree with what he said. And Serenity just happens to be one of my favorite movies of all time. So it was hard to come up with stuff. Though I wasn't, I admit that I wasn't looking for the negative.
I think also because in my case, I don't want to say this wrong, but I kind of expect a lot of negative stuff. Mm-hmm. I expect a TV show to have more sexuality than I'm going to want to see. I expect, you know, there to be more violence or blasphemy or whatever it is in a popular book, because that's just how things go.
Yeah.
So if I find the positive part, I'm so excited about it that I want to talk about the thing that surprised me.
Right.
And I'm not surprised by that negative stuff usually.
Yeah, that's true.
Sadly.
Yeah, it's, you know, it doesn't stand out, does it?
No, mm-hmm. It should. That'd be nice, but it doesn't.
It does not.
So.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the feedback, and please, you know, write us anytime.
Yes, definitely.
For sure.
We like to hear it.
Yeah. Maybe we ought to come up with a forum or something somewhere. Maybe we'll do that in the future.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll talk about that.
We will.
Yes.
Okay. how about this week's book? Black Cherry Blues by James Lee Burke. Now this is the third book in his series that involve a character named Dave Robichaux, who is, in this book, he's an ex-cop in New Iberia, Louisiana, which is pretty close to New Orleans, if I understand that right.
That's right.
And he, in this book, he runs a bait shop on the bayou after having left the... He's no longer a police officer. I said he was an ex-police officer. Now, he lives with Alifair. Alifair is a first grader. Robichaux and his wife, Annie, in the previous book, which is called Heaven's Prisoners, adopted Alifair. So she's about 6 years old. But unfortunately, something happened to Annie in that second book. And in this book, Robichaux finds himself alone with Alifair. He's raising her by himself.
Mm-hmm.
So in this book, just a quick synopsis, one of Dave's old friends, Dixie Lee Pugh, that was him, right?
Yeah.
Dixie Lee Pugh comes to town, and he's got some troubles. And
as his friends often do.
As his friends often do. And he ends up in the hospital and convinces Dave to come talk to him about these troubles that he's having. And Robichaux, against his better judgment, ends up going to the hospital, visits Dixie Lee Pugh, and has a conversation out in the parking lot that pretty much sets into motion the rest of the book. He ends up getting accused of murder, Dave Robichaux does.
Yeah.
And he spends the rest of the book basically trying to clear that up by solving the murder himself, that murder and other murders that this the real killer had committed. So I picked this book for a couple of reasons. The first one is I just absolutely love James Lee Burke's writing style.
Oh my gosh,
you know,
yes.
Yeah, and we talked to, you know, Alden Bell. I don't think Alden Bell was Southern, was he? But the book was Southern.
So.
It was like he was writing a Southern Gothic.
Mm-hmm.
And then here I've got now James Lee Burke is a Southern writer who just writes beautifully. I mean, so both of the books, yes, that we've talked about so far on this podcast have exceptional writing.
And, yes, they do.
Yeah. These are fantastic on audio too, by the way. I don't know if you've listened to any audio, but.
Well, I was thinking about that. However, these are, I'm not sure gritty is a strong enough word for, mm-hmm, these books.
Yeah.
They can be extremely graphic when describing some of the violence, like usually things that are seen in pictures or things like that. And so I was really interested in listening to them on audio, and I thought, wait a minute, I always have to skim over those parts.
Oh, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough to skim an audiobook.
Yes.
Yeah, now the early books were narrated for recorded books by Mark Hammer, and he is absolutely terrific. And then they were taken over, I think that they changed audiobook companies, and, mm-hmm, they were taken over by Will Patton, who's a famous actor.
Oh.
And Will Patton does a good job, but in our house, we like Mark Hammer.
The early books rule.
Yeah, he's just got this style that it's like, oh, why would you not have Mark Hammer read?
Does
the rest
he have
of
that
it?
Nolan's drawl?
Oh,
he does. New Yorker.
He does fantastic accents. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I should mention too, there's about 18 books in this series. If I looked it up earlier, I don't have it up here, but
yeah,
I've read the first six, and the sixth one is called "In the Electric Mist with the Confederate Dead." And so there's been two movies based on these books. Both of them were misses, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Heaven's Prisoners was made into a movie with Alec Baldwin. And talk about a miscasting. I mean, that's not even close.
Yeah.
I don't know how that happened.
I can't even imagine
him as
this character.
Now, the other one is called In the Electric Mist. And it's actually a fairly recent release, but I think it went straight to DVD because I remember we were waiting for it to come out. We were kind of excited, and then we found out it was a DVD release, and we're like, oh, darn, you know, it must not be all that good. But it was okay. Mm-hmm. And Tommy Lee Jones was Robichaux.
That'd be much better,
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
much closer.
Which would give anybody who hasn't read these books an idea of what the character's like.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And Tommy Lee Jones, to me, is really well cast. And Robichaux, in this book, he's 50 years old or so. So he's not a young guy.
No, and he's got a lot of baggage.
He does have one heck of a lot of baggage.
I had always heard of this series, but I had never read any of them until you said this book. And so I started the book, and then I said, oh, okay, I love this style of book anyway, you know, the scoundrel with a heart of gold kind of thing.
Right.
Although he's not so much a scoundrel. And not so much a heart of gold, as it turns out. But sorry, am I getting personal?
No, that's okay.
This is the one for it. Mm-hmm. But so I went back and read the first two, which is Neon Rain and then Heaven's Prisoners, because I was interested to see what the whole background was. Although they fill you in pretty well at the beginning of Black Cherry Blues,
mm-hmm,
on the important events. And I was really surprised by how lyrically beautiful this writing is. It is so evocative of place. And I have been to St. Martinville, and I have been to New Orleans a couple of times. And that's not a ton of experience, but it was enough for me to just go, wow, I could feel myself back there.
Hmm.
It was really great. And unfortunately for me, just from my point of view, that also translated to when he was going, oh, and then extreme violence happened.
Mm-hmm.
And there it was. I was like, oh, no, I could see that too. So he's really good at whatever he writes.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking right before the podcast. Part of this novel happens in Montana, and, mm-hmm, part of it is set in New Orleans. So that's like New Orleans is down the road a piece from you, and Montana, mm-hmm, is down the road a piece from me. And I've been to the places in Montana that he talks about, and yeah, it's spot on. He's a terrific writer.
Yeah, he's good. He can really capture that. And it's unusual, I think, for a noir-style, gritty novel like this to have such pauses for describing the landscape around you. But it really works really well.
It's terrific. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for this podcast, I selected this book, pretty much the series, I guess, because Dave Robichaux is Catholic.
And, boy, is he.
Yeah, and he goes to Mass regularly. He prays. He goes to confession. He's not a saint.
Right? He's not even... He's not even what you would call, and this is something we could talk about maybe in the spoilers, he's not even what you would call a regular Catholic so much as he kind of seems to cling to the big pieces of it to get himself through. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. Mm-hmm. It's just he's saying he goes to confession, he goes to Mass, makes it sound like, you know, he's living next door to the church and just trotting over to talk to the priest all the time. And it's really kind of like you take one of these big action movies and every so often the guy goes, man, I just had this happen. I better go to confession. I was reading Heaven's Neon Rain, and I was like, wow, he's praying the rosary all night to get through, because he's an alcoholic.
Right. Yeah.
So he's in AA, and that's a big part of his persona. And he's like trying to keep from drinking one night. He prays the rosary all night. And I was like, did I read that right? Wait a minute. And then later on, his police chief or whoever's his supervisor is saying, because he's going through a hard time, he's saying, well, you're a smart man. You've read St. John of the Cross. This is your dark night of the soul. So, you know, get used to it.
Yeah,
and I was like, well, I don't know the last time I've read that in a novel like this. Oh, never. And that was my inkling that maybe the author was Catholic. And I liked that combining of the fact that this is just a part of who he is.
Right.
Not apologizing for it, not hiding it, and struggling with it, too.
Yeah, he does struggle with it, but, you know, I don't think that he's spending one heck of a lot of time, you know, questioning whether God exists and that type of thing. It's just really part of him. Mm-hmm. And, the stuff that he has to deal with and some of the stuff that he causes.
Heaven's Prisoners, the whole book.
Yeah, so, but yeah, that struck me. It's not typical. It's not typical.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
So that made it much more interesting to read in terms of not evaluating or judging him really, but just kind of, was so unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it more real to me because, you know, people do exist in a world of their beliefs. Even if their beliefs are purely in science or something else, that's part of them.
Mm-hmm.
So to talk about them, I like that.
Yeah, yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I wanted to mention about picking this book is I picked this one, you know, why didn't I pick number one? And the reason that I picked Black Cherry Blues over one and two was because I felt like this is where he really hit it out of the park. To me, this kind of has all of the elements that James Lee Burke likes to put in these. And one of those elements is the supernatural. There's a supernatural. Yeah, there's a supernatural element to this one that wasn't in the first two.
Mm-hmm. It's hinted at in the first one, I think, where he talks about the lake that he, or the pond or something that he lived near, and how he really felt that there was, you know, there had been a Nazi submarine in there during World War II, or maybe it was off the bay, the Gulf.
Yeah.
And he always really kind of felt that he'd seen the submarine, and then there was the family that had died on the raft, and he felt that they were the things that kept their good souls, were the things that kept those evil ones from doing anything. And that was all in his imagination. I realize this sounds disjointed if you haven't read the book, but I was really surprised at that because it was just kind of laid out there like, well, that's just something I thought, but I really felt it was true. And that's also not the kind of thing you expect a character like this to even consider.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually very rooted in the concrete. And so the fact that he just kind of went, here you go. I'm just going to let you have that one.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting, I thought.
Right. And in this book, his wife, Annie, visits him several times throughout. And, you know, I don't know it's never explicitly said, you know, that this is really Annie, or if this is basically his subconscious trying to convince him of what's true. Go ahead.
Well, I think it is said. I mean, I think, or are we in spoiler territory? Let me see if I can.
Should we? we can jump right into that. Well, let's do, because we're flirting on the edge of it all around.
Yeah,
so,
sorry.
So yeah, we're going to go ahead and if you'd like to read this book before hearing too much about it, this is the time where you'd go ahead and hit pause and go read the book and then hit play.
That's right. Exactly. Because, oh, good. Now.
Okay.
Yes. Done. Because for one thing, he is told by, I can't remember the girl's name, Darlene.
Yeah.
The Indian girl.
Right.
After the dream that would make no sense to anybody just reading about it, he sits up and he knows where to go look.
Right. Now, what did you think of that? Did you feel that that took away from the book or added to the book? You know, because I could see people being annoyed by that, saying, well, you know, he's spent all this time trying to solve something, and then, boom, he's given the answer that he needs at the right time.
But considering the fact that he was really tied into that mystical world of his wife and his father both coming to see him.
Yeah.
And you didn't know if it was a dream, of course, or you didn't know. And, of course, you know, if you're going to look at the Catholic side, God communicates with people through dreams.
Right.
Bible and, you know, other things like that. And it could have been his subconscious. That was fine. I could have lived with that. Although the more it went on, the more there were details that I didn't expect you to have in some kind of a subconscious thing. Just about the way she would act, or, you know, like pulling her dress away from her when it was wet and things like that. But that could give that. But when the Indian girl showed up and told him something completely new, that's when I went, oh, this is all real then.
Right, right.
Okay. That's, and to me, that's part of a reality that I don't expect, but I can accept. Because just enough odd things have been told to me by people who I know and trust, or I've experienced a couple things myself, not like that, believe me, but where you just go, you know, there are plenty of things that we don't understand. And he's so Catholic and ready for that, that I think that girl was like, you're just not getting it. I'm going to communicate with you however it is. And if you believe in the communion of the saints, they're helping us too.
Right, right.
She was dead, and so wherever she was helping. And so that didn't bother me. And then when they left at the end, when he's fishing or pulling in the traps or whatever he's doing, and his wife and father come and say goodbye and leave him forever.
Yeah.
That made it, to me, that was real. Yeah, that was the final confirmation.
Okay. Yeah, but, and I agree. I hadn't thought of the, you know, I'm not saying that it bothered me at all, but I could see, you know, like with a book like The Stand, you know, when God moves in The Stand, a lot of people found that just destroyed the book for him, because why didn't he do that a long time ago, you know? And in this book, you know, why wasn't he given information earlier, I guess is what I feel like people would say. But
it didn't
bother me in that way.
No. And I also feel that if you're going to talk about it from a purely just a personal point of view, are we always listening?
Yeah.
You know, and then you get into the whole subject of free will, which is everybody has to be given the chance to do the right thing, the bad people and the good people. And that's why a lot of bad stuff happens, because, you know, if everybody starts getting in the way and stopping the bad guys because, oh, they're going to do something bad, that doesn't give them the chance for redemption.
Right.
Look at his partner, Cleet, or Dixie Lee Pugh, however small their steps were. And then, because this was something I was really impressed by, if Cleet had not done all that bad stuff, which I was astonished to find out how bad he'd been.
Yeah.
He was very bad.
Very.
he was a bad boy. And needed that forgiveness, the main character of the book, Dave Robichaux, would have been lessened, because he wouldn't have had the chance to extend full forgiveness to Cleet. And he extended full and free forgiveness, and that made a difference to Cleet that was visible, and you could feel it. It was like this sudden relief, because we've all had that, oh, it's okay. I don't have to carry that around anymore.
Right.
you might still struggle with it yourself, but you don't have it from the other person. And so I was completely impressed by, he really did seem to forgive him. He forgave Dixie Lee Pugh a number of things when he let him stay with him, trusted him with Allifair.
Yeah.
And
I was like, what?
I know. Yeah, thank you. Because I was like, oh, but I want her to live.
Yeah.
I was worried about her.
Right. And, so, yeah, to clarify for the listeners.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. The Cletus Purcell was in the first book, he was Dave Robichaud's partner. And I recall a line in Neon Rain where it said something like, "And now Cletus did something that changed my life forever."
Yes.
When they had confronted two people in a car, they pulled them over as cops, and Cletus got into a fight with one of the people in the car and did some not good stuff to him. So Robichaud's life was affected by Cletus Purcell. And then Dixie Lee Pugh, in the beginning of this book, when he brought Dave in, you know, he knew what he was doing. He knew that Dave was going to be wrapped into this. And that, you know, was also not a very nice thing to have done.
Well, yeah, he knew that the people he was dealing with were essentially, one of them is a homicidal maniac.
Mm-hmm.
Really clinical. I mean,
yeah.
And he deliberately exposed him and his little girl to that.
And his little girl to that, right. So I guess I wanted to make sure that was clear. So that Dave Robichaud's forgiveness was not something minor.
No.
This is huge, life-changing stuff.
And in fact, something that, it was an interesting look at forgiveness from the outside, because that's why I find this character interesting. And I've already requested from the library the next two books in the series.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm.
Because you had commented on the fact that I really liked Neon Rain. I did not like Heaven's Prisoners that much, mm-hmm. which I can tell you why in a minute. But okay. And then I liked this one better. Mm-hmm. And this one, though, because I was watching from the outside and I had to think about it on that whole forgiveness thing, I was thinking, you know, he's not as smart as I would expect. I like a hero who's a little bit smarter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when there's a hitman after him, I knew who the hitman was in the neighborhood. I'm sorry he didn't get it. But hello.
Hello.
I was like, no, don't turn your back on him. Oh, too late. And so then, though, later on, he goes at the end of the book, he knows that something has been done to, what's that guy's name? The gangster's plane.
Oh,
Sally
Lee. Yeah, Sally Lee. Yeah.
And he knows that goes to warn him and say, your plane has been messed with. And this guy the entire time is breathing out one vicious threat after another, mm-hmm. about how he's going to destroy Dave Robichaud. And Dave Robichaud's like, no, I'm serious here. And he's like, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to scare me again. And I looked at that and I just went, okay, now that's just idiotic.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked at it from the point of view of thinking about forgiveness. And I thought, wow, that's really a stand-up, essentially very Catholic thing to do.
Yeah,
he's doing the right thing because he's not going to worry about the future. He's got to live with the fact that he knows about it, and he's going to give him that chance.
Right.
And I was incredibly impressed with that.
Yeah, and I think forgiveness is a theme throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, I should mention, I mean, the book is in first person from Robichaud's point of view.
Oh, yes.
So, really, this book is about Dave Robichaud, the character Dave Robichaud. Pretty much, you know, the first two are as well, but
well, and that's why I was having trouble with the series, actually, because I was glad you picked Black Cherry Blues by the end, because if I'd read Neon Rain and then said, oh, Heaven's Prisoners, I would have probably stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm led to expect a certain type of hero, that hard-boiled, not so nice on the outside, kind of that Raymond Chandler-esque sort of a hero, or Dashiell Hammett's written. But, you know, they've got a heart of gold. They're going to do the right thing in the end. And they're pretty much a stand-up guy, though they don't think so nicely of themselves. And other people might talk them down.
Mm.
And then that's who you see in Neon Rain, pretty much.
Yeah.
In Heaven's Prisoners, I was unbelievably disappointed with this guy because his lack of listening to anybody else and his pigheadedness got his wife killed, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
When they kept saying, this is your fault, I was like, yeah, they're right. It is your fault. She was asking you, I mean, you know, not saving Allifair from the plane when it went down, which is how she got in their life. But
mm-hmm.
when Annie said, just let it drop after this, well, he didn't.
Yeah,
he wouldn't. And because he thought he knew so much more and he was going to take care of it, he was going to show everyone. Well, what happened is he wound up paying for it with Annie's life and then his own guilt. And then the other part of, and this may be a guy versus a girl way to look at, you know, mm-hmm. the difference is very soon after his wife dies, he winds up getting involved physically with that stripper. I can't remember. Robin, is that her name? Or
yeah, it's been too long since I've read that one.
Yeah,
I wanted to read that one before the podcast. I didn't get it done, though.
But what happened is that he seems to have this misunderstanding that anytime he's attracted to someone, it equates to love.
Mm-hmm.
And he always acts on it physically. I mean, if the girl's even halfway good looking, he's thinking about it. And from a woman's point of view, I just looked at that and went, what?
Yeah,
she's just dead. And you just went to Florida. I don't care how bad off you are, man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't understand the addictive personality the way this writer seems to, because that's part of his addictive personality.
Right.
But I was left very disillusioned with Dave Robichaux. So I was glad to read Black Cherry Blues because that seemed kind of to show, okay, now he's coming through this. He's learned. He's not going to, he's only doing what he needs to. He's going to do the police report. He went to talk to his friend in the hospital, Dixie Lee Pugh, after the accident. He goes to make the police report and then he's ready to let it drop.
So you felt that he did progress some from the last
book. Yeah, I felt he progressed personally a lot in this book, which is why I was curious to see what's done in the next ones because he's definitely imperfect.
Yeah, there was a moment in this book that made me wonder when his daughter is threatened via a letter by these guys that beat up Dixie Lee Pugh. So, and the same people that he had the conversation with in the parking lot of the hospital that I mentioned earlier. So Dave Robichaux's reaction to that was to take care of it himself because he didn't think that the police were going to help him at this point. And that was a tough moment for me because although I can completely understand his reaction, it was extreme. Mm-hmm. And I realized that he felt like he was in danger, but I was just like, oh man, what he did is he went to their hotel room, took a chain and, really just beat the hell out of them. These two guys. Yeah. But it took a threat to his daughter to do that. His first grade daughter.
You know, and the funny thing is I'd forgotten that. I remembered the result of that, which is that the psychotic guy basically takes that as a chance to kill the other person and blame it on Dave Robichaux.
Right. So Dave Robichaux hurts these guys with a chain, you know, beats the heck out of them and leaves. And then one of the two says, okay, I'm going to kill this other guy and blame it on Robichaux.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Robichaux gets arrested the next day for murder.
Mm-hmm.
And that he didn't commit. And then that's the rest of the book is spent unraveling that problem.
But he's written about it in a very real way because when he's in prison, he's worried.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to go to the big house or whatever, right. You know, Angola or whatever, because he knows what an ex-cop is going to get there.
Right.
And that's not something you usually see in this sort of a character.
Yeah. And you don't usually see monetary problems. I mean, he's not running around. I mean, you know, money exists in this book.
people should lend him money if he's like the other people, you know.
Right.
And he does go and ask, it's not a federal guy, is it?
The DEA? The DEA.
DEA.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So then he says, well, I've got to have help.
Yeah, I've got to have help. Right. Now, when he decides to go to Montana was another huge moment for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because he spent, you know, I don't know how many times in the book it said, you know, I found somewhere for Allifair to go. Alifair is the name of his daughter. Yeah. And then I went and did this. And then I found someplace for Alifair to go. And then I went and did this. And then he decided that he was going to go to Montana. And one of the guys that works for him, named Baptiste, in his bait shop, told him, hey, you can't just keep leaving this girl around. You need, you know, are you family or not, is really what he said.
Yeah.
But then he took Alifair with him to Montana. And I was just like, ah, you know, I felt, it's like, okay, yeah, it's great to be, you know what you're going up there to do.
And, family's great, but here's the thing, Baptiste doesn't really get it. So,
Remember the scene where the chain that he used to beat those guys up was in the floor of his truck, and his daughter gets in and says, hey, what's this? He's like, oh, that's the chain. Let me shove this under the seat because
it's got paint on it.
Yeah, it was just like, wow. but Alifair's presence in the whole book was both a calming influence on him and a mm-hmm. tension builder for me for the whole thing, because I kept mm-hmm. worrying about her the entire time. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know. I think once you have kids, things change. You know, yes. when you read books, I don't know if this happened to you, but. You know, yep. I could watch horror stories, you know, movies, whatever, and then I had kids and it changed. I mm-hmm. don't know if those became just a more vital thing. You know, you're like, oh, you know, holy cow, I can't think about this right now.
No, or, I agree. Life is more precious. You take it more seriously, maybe.
Yeah, it could be. It could
be. Yeah, because you just relate to your kids more. I know. Yeah. It was the same for me.
Yeah.
And I know some things I try to reread that I would read when I was like a college kid or something. And I'm, oh, no, can't do that. Yeah, Alifair was kind of interesting, too, because I also kept thinking he just keeps leaving her uh-huh. everywhere. And this kid has been left and abandoned, but not intentionally, yeah. but by everybody who she's ever loved. And she was from South America somewhere where she tells him during the book that, you know, oh, yes, I know the soldiers in my village, just like happened to Miss Annie, who was his wife.
Yeah.
That's what they would do to the people in my village. So she understands violence. And she's sure an does. Interesting combination, therefore, of shrewdness and innocence. And not shrewdness in an unchildlike way, but just that she'll suddenly get very serious. And he'll suddenly realize what he's exposed her to.
Mm-hmm. And he feels terrible about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wrote down one of the quotes that I wrote down in this book was the moment where Baptiste tells him, hey, you know, you can't leave her everywhere. And I'd like to just read this part. Mm-hmm. So this is Dave Robichaux speaking. It's in first person. Disney films, Kool-Aid, Bodine. What is that word? B-O-U-D-I-N.
Oh, that's a sausage, a kind of sausage. Okay.
Do I say it right? Boudin?
Yeah, Boudin.
Boudin, okay. Disney films, Kool-Aid, Boudin, Blue Point crabs on a breezy porch by the side of the bay were probably poor compensation for the losses she had known. But you offer what you have, perhaps even bless it with a prayer, and maybe somewhere down the line, affection grows into faith and replaces memory. I can't say. I'm not good at the mysteries. And I have few solutions even for my own problems. But I was determined that Alifair would never again be hurt unnecessarily, not while she was in my care, not while she was in this country. Anyway, that struck me.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, and it's beautiful writing, but it struck me because I was worried about Alifair all the time. Just pretty much all the time. So,
yep.
You know, when he's packing around, throws her in the pickup truck, drives her to Montana, where he's planning to deal with these guys the way that he deals with things. And, you know.
Yeah, except for the fact that I was of two minds. I felt that way. But I also kept thinking about the fact that the reason he reacted initially was that they had threatened her.
Yeah.
They didn't mm-hmm. threaten him. They showed him horrible pictures and said, we'll do this to your daughter. And so
mm-hmm.
if he left her somewhere, that would just make her that much easier to get to.
Yep. And it would have changed everything had she not been with him the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
I think that she was a calming influence on him all the time. It made him second guess things sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe, you know, like you're saying, you know, with the chain and the thing, he's like, whoa, you know, I really did that. And boy, I really exposed her to this.
And, yeah. Because of my rashness.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I had forgotten that But that was in reaction to when I was saying that, you know, he didn't really make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, he did react extremely then.
Right, but
he was, I think, in a sense, what's kind of interesting, even though he lives a life that we'll never see, please, Lord, is that he's still struggling with all the things we do. How do you deal with your family? How do you deal with loss? Because the things that change him are not only his faith and his trust in God and his wrestling through his addiction of it's that family thing. Mm-hmm. And I know that one of the things that makes is a seminal moment for him toward the end of the book is when he suddenly says, I've really got control of nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing in my life. And he thinks about AA, he thinks about Annie, and then he stops and says, maybe I should look at the things that have happened instead of the bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, now I'm going to read for a second.
Okay, go ahead.
He says, maybe as I had told Dixie Lee in the hospital, it was time to look at the things that I had rather than at the problems that seemed to beset me without a solution. I was sober, even though I had set myself up for a fall by not attending meetings. When I had wanted to join Annie in that watery place more than anything in the world, I had gone into therapy rather than let that morning arrive when I would awaken in the blue-gray light, sit quietly on the side of my bed in my underwear, and fit the iron sight of my .45 against the roof of my mouth. And last, I had Allifair, who was given to me inside a green bubble of air from below the Gulf's surface, which is referring to when he has saved her from the plane that crashed, which is how they found her. But I just looked at that, and I thought the things that are tying him to a real life, that's really, it's really Allifair. He stayed alive, I'm positive, for her.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it's the power of your family at that point.
Right.
And people that you love and that love you.
I agree. That's powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to make sure to mention, you know, with forgiveness kind of being a theme of the novel,
mm-hmm.
One of them, it's appropriate as a Catholic that he attends confession. And he does at one point in this book, he finds a priest when he's in Montana, and he goes to a confession, and he tells him about all this. You know, I told him about Annie, the shotgun blast that leapt in the darkness. You know, it's just like that. And then he says, it won't go away, Father. I don't believe it ever will. And then the priest says, I feel inadequate in trying to advise you, but I think you're a good man and you're doing yourself an unnecessary injury, you know? So he tells him what he thinks, but I thought that was a really interesting scene and powerful for Dave Robichaud to go to that confession. And, mm-hmm. you know, it made me think of, you know, my own life and all that stuff, you know, not that I have things to confess like he does, but.
Well, let's hope not.
Yeah. But confession, I haven't had a lot of success at confession as a Catholic. Meaning that I haven't had an experience that I would call a good experience at confession. Yeah, the very last time that I went, I really prepared hard. You know, I made a list of things that I wanted to talk about, and I did mm-hmm. it. And the priest said, this isn't supposed to be a laundry list. And I was like,
ouch.
Well, what is it supposed to be?
Well, that's, I was like, you know, it's one thing to say that, but then, and it's, you should maybe try this.
Yeah.
Nothing like that. Huh?
No, nothing like that. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, but so I haven't had a lot of success as, you know, maybe I'm not approaching it the right way.
Well, but, you know, I think I would, you mentioned this and I did have a chance to think about it. So, mm-hmm. And I don't know if I come at it from a different place since I'm a convert. Mm-hmm. But I never really, our priest, who did really a great job of preparing us for RCIA, he said, he told us, don't make a laundry list.
Mm-hmm.
Go at least once a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, not too often because you don't want to get into the minutia. He goes, but what you're looking for is what's cutting you off from God? What are the things that you're doing that would hurt you with, you know, being able to talk to God, like, you know, with your, in your case, with your wife or me, with my husband, you know, we'll have to stop suddenly and go, oh, I just realized I'm doing this and I'm sorry. And I'll try not to do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so a laundry list doesn't help with those people, but kind of realizing that big thing or a little repetitive thing, does. And so that was kind of his advice. And so what I try to do, because my problem is, if you ask me for a laundry list, I can hardly ever think of anything. And that sounds awful. It sounds like I think I'm so perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's more that I have trouble relating to some of the things, like I'll think of something and I'll, oh, wait, that is something like, oh, gluttony, you're right, that falls in that category. Huh. And so I have to process it more. But so what I have to do usually is I ask God. I ask the Holy Spirit and say, what is it that is getting in the way? What do I need to know? Because I'm not seeing it. I'm too blind. And if I start thinking about that and praying that for 3 or 4 days, it's surprising how it's either something like every time I turn around, I'm losing my temper over nothing. And I finally go, oh, okay, I get it. All right, something to write down on my, you know, think about list and to talk about, or some bigger theme will emerge to me that's very clear. And it's usually I have 2 or 3 big things. And so when I go in there, I'm just like, okay, I have all the usual little stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I may name a couple of little things. I'm like, but these are the 2 or the 3 biggies that are getting in my way in my relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
And every priest I've ever gone to has been fine with that.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's helpful. That's just
it is helpful. You know, most of the stuff I've looked at, you know, online, you know, they say, you know, you do this examination of conscience, and there's even some outlines for that, you mm-hmm. know, I've looked at, and you're like, oh, well, you know, you think about that, but doing it how you're talking about doing it, that makes sense to me and something that I'm going to try to do.
Well, I'd be curious to hear if it helps at all, because that's just, for me, it works.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was a cradle Catholic, you know, I mentioned that in the about section of that website. And
mm-hmm.
I remember going to confession as a kid, and that's exactly what we did. You know, you're like, okay, what did I do? Okay, well, I didn't listen to my parents. I didn't do this. And then you'd go into the little room and you'd go through the list. And then mm-hmm. you'd say, all right, you know, say 5 Hail Marys or whatever. But it was never a satisfying thing. You know, I don't know that I ever understood it then. And then at age 13, I fell away. That was kind of an event. I didn't come back until I was probably, 25, 26. But it was always on my mind and stuff. So, but that's been my experience with confession, is just that. You know, and so every now and then I'll do it and it'll feel the same way. And I'll go, well,
yeah, you know,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think maybe also that idea of, and this may be part of the newer, you know, post-Vatican II church, that we feel like we have to feel something.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's because, you know, every so often I'll come away going, man, I feel like I'm walking on air. Everything's great. But I don't think we have to feel anything necessarily. I mean, we have to trust God to do some of the work, or mm-hmm. a lot of the work. For us, the work is the examination and the going in, because just to say that stuff sometimes to someone without giving the excuses, that's a workout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just here it is, baldly, this, and this. I'm not even going to tell you why, because then I'm starting to make excuses, and I can't, because that's not the point. And it's then that God's, you know, giving, you know, the priest, God through the priest or Jesus, is giving absolution, but also you get extra grace to help fight it next time. And you can't always feel that stuff. Sometimes you just have to, it's like the Eucharist, you know, you just take it on faith.
Yeah.
Now, I do always try to remember to pray for the priest, because they're human, and boy, have I heard of a lot of bad confession experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a couple, 3 good ones, but maybe because I just don't ever expect anything out of it, other than, because I've already done a lot of my thinking ahead of time, and when I realize it, I'm like, oh man, I am sorry. Oh, dang, sorry about that barking.
That's all right. Hello, puppies.
But, and so when I go in there, I'm kind of, to me, it's kind of like, ooh, I did get this ticket. I better go pay it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm paying, it's stamped, now I go away and I don't have to worry about that anymore. So I don't expect necessarily, if it's kind of like, okay, I'm doing this final thing because this happens, even though I don't feel it. I'm fulfilling this final part of the confession, repentance, or penance and reconciliation. Because I want to get to the reconciliation part.
Right.
Sorry, I guess I went on too
long. No, that's very helpful. I appreciate it. Now, what about in Mass, we say that little confession.
Mm-hmm.
What about that? What is it there for if not, you know, I know several Catholics who just do that and never go to confession. Yeah, I do.
I'm sorry.
But
I hate to be shocked. Well, let's see. The point of that is so that because you're not supposed to go have communion if you aren't clean, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that's for venial sins. That's for I lost my temper, I cut off all these people in line, I blah, blah, blah. And so really, unless you have a mortal sin, I guess it's, you know, which is something that you've planned and that's horrible, like, you know, murder. A lot of things Dave Robichaux could go for here.
Mm-hmm.
He's got several.
Hit somebody with a chain.
Check. Yeah, hit somebody with a chain with malice aforethought. But you're supposed to go once a year to proper reconciliation, they call it, according to the catechism. And one thing they did say in here, because I looked it up, because you mentioned you were going to talk about confession, is I think the thing we forget is, and I'll do this too, but we tend to think of it as this, I have to go confess, and then I do it, and I check it off my list, which is kind of what I just talked about. But the reason the church, as that priest always said, they don't want you to do it just because it's fun to mark it off their list. Everything that they ask you to do is for your own good, to help you get closer to God.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only reason any of that stuff exists at all, period.
Gotcha.
And so when they're advising you the minimum. And he's like, but do we always want to do the very minimum when we're trying to reach Christ? Wouldn't we want to try to do more? Do you want to do the minimum with your husband or wife or your children? No, you want to go above and beyond. He goes, so we should try to do that for God too. And so one thing they say in here is, without being strictly necessary, confession of everyday faults, venial sins, is nevertheless strongly recommended by the church. Indeed, the regular confession of our venial sins helps us form our conscience, fight against evil tendencies, let ourselves be healed by Christ, and progress in the life of the Spirit. By receiving more frequently through this sacrament the gift of the Father's mercy, we are spurred to be merciful as He is merciful. Which suddenly made me think of Dave Robichaux.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me
at
too.
The end, you know, he's being merciful when he goes to, I can't remember his name, that gangster.
Yeah, Sally Lee.
Sally Dio.
Yep.
Yeah. Or when he forgives Cleet.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and we're called upon to do that as well.
Yeah, ourselves. And that's part of the going to confession, you know, say once a quarter or so. It's enough to keep you honest and paying attention, but not so much that it all piles up.
Right.
Or, I mean, not so much that, you know, you're doing the laundry list, but so that before Mass thing, that's just kind of for that. It's not for overall, because you're not thinking about it really.
Sure. Yeah. Well, interesting. Thank you very much. I enjoyed that. Thank you.
No, I hope. Sorry. I do tend to go on as
no,
we know.
No, I appreciate that very much.
So,
but yeah, I still highly recommend, well, I do highly recommend this book. It is, you know, you'd say it's rated R for sure.
Oh gosh.
You know, gritty. I like the Dave Robichaux character. He does shock me sometimes. like with the chain thing, you're just like, you know, what are you doing? But you know, overall he's a struggling guy and you know, trying to get by and gets in these terrible situations and, you know, having to get out of them. You know, they're tough moral situations too.
Yeah, and on some level, I think they're all situations that we can relate to somehow, because you were shocked by the chain thing. I completely forgot it.
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked by the sex stuff. I mean, not the fact that he did it, because that's what all these characters seem to do,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that as a Catholic, he never stops to even think twice. Uh-huh. Oh, that school teacher, she was kind of attracted to me. I could tell, but I didn't do it. And like he expects a medal.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. This is how I read it. And so and I was just like, really? How do you square that? But then you start to see in the book, you're kind of shown he's got a reason for having some women issues because of his mother. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's dealt with later on because he is struggling. And we all struggle all the time.
Yeah. Yep.
So I recommend this series. I'm curious to see where it goes, at least in the next few books.
Well, good. That's great.
Yeah.
Yep.
I do not have anything nearly as gritty for next time. We're going to watch an Australian comedy.
Oh, that's right. And I've got it right here.
Oh, do you?
Yes. The Castle. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm the Castle. And I'm always surprised that nobody ever seems to have heard of it.
Yeah. And I have not ever heard of it. So I'm excited. It looks like my kind of stuff. So, The Castle. There's no place like this home. Fantastic. Yes. All right.
The theme is family. So. Yeah.
And the next book I also have right here.
Yes.
By Josephine Tay.
Right?
Yeah.
We're going.
It looks almost like an F on the front of this.
South. One. No American South anymore. We're going to England in maybe the 1950s or 60s.
Cool.
I'd have to look.
The Franchise Affair is what it's called.
Yes.
So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Great. Well, did you have something extra for today?
Oh, I do.
Fantastic.
I don't know if you've ever watched this series called The Good Wife.
No, I haven't.
Stars Juliana Margulis, if that's how you say her name, and I can't remember the actor. Probably. I didn't ever watch it, but I think she was on TV a lot, and she's absolutely beautiful and a wonderful actress. And it's produced by Tony Scott and Ridley Scott.
No kidding.
Which
one of those is responsible for Alien, I think.
That's right. Yeah. And the other one directed ads and then now directs movies. I think more blow 'em up movies, if I'm right, but I can't remember. Tony Scott. But they're brothers. And the only reason I bring that up is because once we noticed that, we said, how involved is he? And evidently Ridley Scott is extremely involved to the point of he'll come through and watch rushes and things like that. But it's a series about, it's kind of one of those ripped from the headline situations where it's set in Chicago, town of corrupt politics, and Juliana Margulis's character is the wife of a politician who is exposed for cheating with a prostitute and sent to prison for land fraud, I believe, is what they're accusing him of. And so she has to stand there. I think, wasn't it Spitzer, whose wife had to stand there with him while he's going, I'm so sorry about that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's at the very beginning of the series, she's standing there looking very meek and mousy and having to be his good wife. But after he goes to prison, she has to start working and supporting their two children. So she goes to a law firm that is run by one of the partners who's a guy she went to school with, college with.
Uh-huh.
And so what happens is you have an overarching story of her and her husband and his political career and, you know, the things he does and doesn't apologize for. And then her day-to-day or, you know, episode-to-episode law firm experience, which turns out to always be a mystery because she's always representing someone or working on a case that they've got to figure out how to get the person out of it.
Hmm.
And it's really well done, subtly acted in many more ways than you'd expect, and very good writing.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I will check it out for certain.
Right. And the reason I was going to mention it is they have a couple of interesting spots where the husband winds up dealing with a minister because he thinks he can help him politically. But what happens is he starts to have to examine his own conscience and his own faith.
Hmm.
And likewise, the daughter just recently has a friend who's one of those, you know, super Christian teenage girls who's like, oh, and I'll pray for you. But because of her influence, the daughter is now starting to do things like pray, and it's treated always with surprise by the wife and all the people around them, but very respectfully in terms of the person's search and its genuineness.
Oh, good.
So, an interesting element.
Yeah. All right, I'm definitely going to check that out.
Yeah. What about you?
I've got one. I listened to an episode of Being from American Public Media. That's an NPR show. I don't know if you've heard of it. Krista Tippett on Being is what the show is called. It used to have a different title.
Faith.
Yeah. I can't remember. I
think I'd listen to a few of them when it had the different name. Okay.
Yeah, and I can't remember the proper name. But anyway, it's called Being now. And the episode is called Quarks in Creation. It's an interview of John Polkinghorne. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Yes. I've always wanted to read one of his books.
Yeah. I've never read any of his books either, and I should. He's an Anglican priest who is also a theoretical physicist.
Okay.
Which is something that pushes all my buttons.
Yeah, me too.
A really nice interview. The description says, science and religion are often pitted against one another, but how do they complement rather than contradict one another? We learn how one man applies the deepest insights of modern physics to think about how the world fundamentally works and how the universe might make space for prayer. So,
that does sound good.
And it is good. It's the episode from, I'm looking at it, January 13th, 2011.
Okay.
And, anyway, well worth listening to. One of the neat things about this podcast that they've been doing, I don't know how long they've been doing it, but I noticed it. One of my favorite folks on the planet is Brother Guy Consolmagno.
Oh, yes.
From the Vatican. Yeah, he's a Vatican scientist. And they interviewed him and another person on this same show. They're both Vatican scientists. And in the podcast feed, they put the show and then the uncut interview. So the uncut interview maybe had, you know, an extra 10 minutes or whatever that they cut down to fit the show. And anyway, this one has it too. They have the uncut interview. So you get in the podcast feed, you get the show and then an uncut interview. So
that's great.
Yeah, it's neat. It's neat. Yeah. You know, really taking advantage of the podcast format, which doesn't have time restraints.
As we're showing today, right?
That's right.
Sadly.
Don't worry, folks. We'll have you home by dinner.
Yep. That's right. It's only 6 more hours to go.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, I sure had a good time.
Yeah, me too.
And thank you very much. I'm glad you liked the book. I was worried after your review of Heaven's Prisoners, I was a little concerned. Because I sure like these books. I sure like these books. And, Dave Robichaux has some troubles.
But I'm really interested in seeing how the rest of the books go. And I'm glad we talked about it because I wouldn't have been forced to read all 3 of these books and think about it this way.
Yeah. Well, good.
So, added an extra dimension. I appreciate it.
All right, you bet. Looking forward to next time, a couple weeks.
Oh, yes. Me too.
So we'll see you in a couple weeks.
See you then.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.